Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk Podcast, episode number 27. This week, we have a good friend of ours joining us again, Dr. Bill Weiss. Dr. Weiss recently just left his job in El Paso, where they are getting decimated by COVID right now. And we start the podcast talking about that. But then we talk about his transition to his new job in Galveston. And we spend a lot of time on the podcast actually talking about developing a sports medicine practice and athletic trainer outreach and associating with teams and team coverage and that whole aspect of orthopedics that doesn't really get talked about outside of sports medicine conferences and meetings. So hope you guys enjoy it. Without further ado, Dr. Bill Weiss. Hey, can we time out? All right, all good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is Time Out. This is the Ortho Talk Podcast. Today we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course, what do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision. One. Welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk Podcast, episode number 27. We have our favorite Canadian back, Bill Weiss. Also, Jay's office mate, partner, right?
Not currently, yep. But
socially distanced office partners.
We're distancing today.
Yeah. How's it going, Bill?
I'm good. Hey, am I your first repeat guest?
No.
You're the first one of the day.
You're the first one of the day. There you go.
First one for episode 27.
Okay. And the month.
Awesome. Very honored. Happy to be back. It was fun the first time. I thought, why not do it again?
And then Jay's got his Christmas lights showing in the back. For listeners who can't see, he's got multicolored Christmas lights on his giant mansion with his giant windows. Jay, how long did it take you to put those up? Huh?
Is that Jay's house?
I think right?
Is it? Yeah.
It took me about 2 minutes to write the check. That's how long it took me to.
I'm wondering how long it took you to put those lights up.
Just 2 minutes to write the check. Someone else did
it. Someone else did it. Okay. They did a nice job.
I fixed several calcanei already, and I don't want to be the next one on the table. So.
You've been doing a lot of calcaneus fractures, haven't you?
I've done 2 calcs and 3 pilons and 4 or 5 trimals.
I thought we stopped fixing calcaneus fractures.
Well, if you do sinus tarsi, you can fix them and not have any complications.
You get Christmas lights like that if you don't fix
calcaneus fractures. Exactly. Somehow you got to pay for the lights.
Some of us have. Yeah.
But yeah. So, Bill, first week on the job.
Yeah. Again.
How's it going?
A victory lap, as they say.
Yeah.
No, back started Monday. Happy to be back. Happy to leave El Paso, but unfortunate that what's happening there right now is a little crazy, but it's good to get myself and my family out of there. I feel bad for my colleagues that are still working there. Things are crazy, but good to be back on the island and in Galveston, Houston, and happy to be back at UTMB.
How bad is it up there right now with COVID?
It's bad.
It's pretty bad, right?
El Paso has more cases of COVID than Dallas and Houston combined, and probably, you know, less than a million people in that city.
Why? Oh, what's going on? Are they all just like clustered in one?
I think it has a lot to do with the border and what's happening in Juarez. Juarez for a long time now has had multiple deaths. They don't have the same testing capabilities that we do here in the U.S. and in El Paso, but their testing, I think, is lagging, and their deaths are multiple and high every day. I've heard and read from friends that, you know, it would be typical that in El Paso, we would send the ambulance over the border 2-3 times a day to pick up patients that would come to UMC for treatment. Now they're going over 14-15 times a day and coming back with COVID positive patients. Wow. So it's been a big influx. I'm not sure of exactly why. It's probably multifactorial, but there's a lot happening in El Paso right now in a bad way.
And how's the hospital handling it?
It is stressed and full.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you saw, but there was a traveling nurse that put out a statement, I guess, on the internet the other day. And I don't want to say that this statement was completely true, because there have been many that have said it's not. But she basically said that things are so bad there that she basically cried her whole way home, and that they basically are having to start to consider rationing care because things are so bad. So I don't know how much of that is true. There have been people that have spoken out and said, no, it's definitely bad, but you know, they're doing the best they can, and things are crazy right now.
Yeah, I think we had that same story in New York and New Orleans, that whole rationing care kind of thing.
Very much like that right now. It's looking a lot like New York, maybe a little worse even.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's sad.
But there's hope on the way. There's two vaccine trials that have shown 95% efficacy, apparently.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Yeah, there's already a plan to have El Paso be one of the sites. I don't know, again, if it's going to follow through, but there's a plan to start immunizing healthcare providers in El Paso even before the end of the year was the plan, but we'll see how the vaccine progresses. But it looks promising.
Would you guys also? I mean, we're probably gonna be told to get the vaccine, I'm guessing. But otherwise, would you all get it?
I would. I'm vaccinated every which way from sideways, as you guys are. Being in healthcare, you know, you have to. And
yeah,
I don't want to get too much into that, of course. It's a very controversial subject, but I think they're safe. And my two sons are vaccinated, and they will get all their vaccinations on time as directed. And my coming daughter will be the same. And I don't understand the other side.
You know, the whole vaccine thing is kind of funny, though, because it's not just like lay people that are scared of vaccines. Like, there are actual physicians who like will not vaccinate their kids.
My question is why? And so, because of reading the answer?
Yeah. So I've had this argument because one of my fellowship attendings is similar to this, where he vaccinated his kids, but he did it on a different schedule because he thinks he's convinced that we overload kids with vaccines too early.
So I'm going to do what I just said I wouldn't do.
we're into it. We're here. My background
is in biochemistry, microbiology, and immunology. And I spent like 7 years studying that before I came to medical school. And the human immune system can handle a huge array of whatever you throw at it. And it does every day. If you think about how many different species of bacteria and viruses we're exposed to, and we fight them all off. There's no evidence to support the fact that you can overwhelm the immune system in any shape or form. And so I think that's naive, and people who believe that don't have a very good understanding of basic immunology. The immune system is sitting there ready to respond, and it's just waiting for antigens, and it can handle innumerable antigens based on your development and splitting up your own. They all come from your own genes, and they split up into innumerable patterns and then form the basis of your immune system. But you can't overload it. It doesn't happen. We would overload it all the time if that was the case. Walking out your front door and touching doorknobs and getting on a bus would expose you to countless pathogens that you would see every day.
Yeah, and I've had this argument with him many times, right? And essentially, his argument boils down to what almost everyone's argument is I had a friend who had a normal kid, and then they got their vaccines, and then they became autistic. And you can't tell me that's not coincidence.
Tell me that it's causative,
Right, right.
I don't know. And I'm nobody understands, but there is definitely a pattern of people who are against vaccines or skeptical of vaccines who have a child themselves or know somebody who's had a child who has a vaccine injury. And I don't know that you can necessarily correlate it with that. You know, they'll also quote the rates of autism are climbing, you know, over the last 20 to 30 years. Didn't know what autism was until 20 or 30 years ago. So, of course, the rates are going to climb, and the diagnostic criteria have changed.
Yeah.
So I am very, very on the side of pro-vaccine here, and I hope that that's obvious, and I don't really apologize for being that way.
I don't think you should. It's a very scientific fact. It really is.
And if you look at the numbers of what vaccines have done to the developed world, it is the greatest invention of mankind, probably maybe after the printing press, which was the greatest invention of the 1900s, I believe. So, I mean, this is something that has changed dramatically our lifespan, the quality of life for children, the practice of medicine, and taking it away, I think it hits such a chord with many of us because people have now been so privileged to experience life where they don't have to worry about these things to the point where they think that they can ignore what has taken hundreds of years to develop and refine to get to the point that we're at, and they can just throw it away because they don't think they like it.
To me, it's fascinating how some of these people are very educated people who are not just educated, but physicians.
Yeah,
and have gone through medical school, and very smart people who are very good at what they do, and still, it's almost like they're too smart for their own good, you know?
Perhaps. Immunology is, I mean, it's not, you and I in medical school got a very cursory kind of broad overview of immunology, and that, you know, it's enough to get us through medical school, but unless you go into that field, you don't really see the intricacies of it, and I think my background has helped me a bit to see many of those things, but even most physicians don't have that background to understand, well, where do these antibodies come from, and how do they get activated, and what happens to the ones that don't find something to react against? And the immune system is something we don't really understand that well in general, but the average physician probably doesn't understand the nitty gritty details of how it works.
I agree with you guys on the efficacy and safety of vaccines as well. And if there's a vaccine for COVID available yesterday, I would have gotten it yesterday. But let me bring it to more of an ethical question then. Do we, you know, we're all in agreement that it works and hopefully it's as safe as they're saying. Do we have the right to enforce people to get the vaccine, healthcare providers and the general public?
That's a hard and very ethical question. I mean, yeah. It kind of goes in my mind along with like obeying the rules of society. Like this is not just about you anymore. This is about all of us. And if we don't achieve herd immunity through vaccination, then people are still at risk. And if you want to play by the rules of and live in society, then you have to play by all the rules. You can't pick and choose. It's just like you can't go and murder someone just because you feel that, well, I don't really think murder is that bad, you know.
Like drunk driving.
I'm not going to pick that rule. I don't like that one. It's my decision. And maybe it is, but, you know, society's decision is, well, you play by society's rules or you don't really get to be a part of it. And that might be a little extreme, but I think it's for the betterment of all of us to play by the rules of the people that are supposed to be our elected leaders. And, you know, that's why we put them there. That's a whole other thing that we probably don't want to get into in November, but.
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely gonna be a correlation between people who don't vaccinate their children and one, believe in conspiracy theories, and two, don't wear masks, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's gotta be very, very well aligned in those two.
Yeah, there's a lot of data now that you can look up that shows you that, I mean, a mask won't protect me, for example, but if I'm sick and I'm wearing a mask, then I'm gonna protect you. And that's really the way that people need to look at it. Nothing that most people will wear will stop a virus from getting in. But if I'm wearing that and sneeze with the virus inside me, the chances of me spreading it are lessened. And that's becoming very clear. There's data and scientific studies now coming out showing how they decrease infection rates and how countries who have been abiding by masks, abiding by stay-at-home rules, have done better than the average country or the United States. Yeah.
And I think, you know, obviously the politicization of all of this hasn't helped at all. And we've turned it into a divisive issue. And now, you know, it's one group versus the other, and that always kind of flares it up. But
that also happened in El Paso. And that I was listening to another podcast yesterday from one of the local media people there. And he was, you know, making the point of the mayor and the governor and the judge of the region of El Paso in Texas were in political knocking one was Republican, one was Democratic, and there were political reasons as well at play here that maybe they're not listening for political reasons, which isn't the right thing to do, of course, but it has become a very political issue.
And it's always a problem when you get politicians involved because nobody trusts politicians ever. So you have governors out there and mayors that are preaching to stay at home, cancel Thanksgiving, do all this stuff. And then they go have massive birthday parties, right? Gavin Newsom just got photographed at a massive restaurant. So, I mean, you know, this guy's spouting stuff that you should be listening to, but you don't want to listen to him because he's not following his own rules.
I mean, I think the best example of that, and again, not to politicize the issue, but Dr. Fauci and President Trump and how they've been going back and forth the whole time this has been going on.
Yeah, no, so I don't know. At some point, we stopped listening to the scientists on this. And, you know, I get both sides of it. I really do. I think, you know, we do need to listen to scientists. But if you give physicians full rein over controlling a virus. They'll do everything that they have to control a virus and screw everything else, right? Screw the economy, screw the government, screw everything else. So you got to have a balance between the two, and you got to listen to the science, but you also have to, you know, find a compromise that works for everyone.
Funny in El Paso right now, they've had shutdown orders that just were ended. They're, you know, friends of mine that own small businesses there were initially defying the order, and then they were in line with the order. And, you know, they're also looking out for their bottom line, which, you know, you have to understand that this is a hard economic time for the entire country. Those small businesses are really suffering, not just in the United States. So that plays into it. I mean, people are trying to make a living and pay their bills and keep the power on at their restaurants, for example.
And this, a second shutdown is very scary for a lot of people. Yeah. And I don't think you're going to get a lot of people to listen the second time, honestly.
I mean, El Paso is a great example of that. People were defying the order.
Yeah. You're going to have revolts in part of the country.
Even the El Paso police put out a statement, again, because of the controversy with the judge and the mayor and the governor all not getting along and saying the same thing. But the El Paso police came out and said, listen, we're not going to be enforcing this right now until we get more clarification on this from somebody. So that put the general populace in a horrible position of, well, what do we do?
Yeah. And El Paso, I mean, we already said this before, but it's a very scary sign that, I mean, I don't know how hard El Paso got hit the first time around. I don't remember it being, you know, as bad as some of the bigger cities.
It was average. We were a little late to the game. You know, I was, of course, still there at that time. And, you know, New York and all these other places were getting hit. El Paso was having a trickle of cases. And that's the real question is why is El Paso being hit so hard? And is it because the people of El Paso didn't follow the rules? Is it a cultural thing? Is it the border city fact of this? I don't really know. I mean, it's that there are many things that could be part of it, but nobody is able to put their finger on anything definitive.
No, but even in cities that got hit hard the first time, like New York is seeing a big uptick in cases now too.
Yeah.
And I think Illinois, I think, is canceling some elective surgeries again because they're getting hit hard again too. So it's definitely coming back. Hopefully this virus, or I mean, this vaccine comes out and, you know, we get enough people to take it to kind of shut this thing down. And I mean, obviously that'd be the best case scenario.
I think the United States has a very big and significant population of people who will refuse the vaccine for their own reasons.
Yeah.
And that's going to hamper our ability to combat this. Canada is the same, and it will also be present there. But it's going to be very interesting to see what happens once we have a vaccine.
Now that we've went to the political and ethical spectrum, let's go to the absurd aspect. Is there a microchip in this vaccine?
I hope so.
I mean,
why else would you take it?
I don't even know if I should say this, but I've seen a lot of like the jokes about, well, if you really think that they're putting a microchip in this vaccine to follow what you're doing, trust me, you're not worth following.
Yeah, and those same people will be on their cell phone and on Facebook Instagram and all that kind of stuff.
I have a vaccine that has a microchip, but I have my phone in my pocket that constantly is pinging my location and what I'm looking at and what I'm buying on Amazon to everybody. Yeah, it's absurd. Absolutely right, Jay.
Absolutely. All right, so I think we've hammered the COVID thing for a while.
Real discussion, real talk.
So let's say... Dr. Weiss, Bill, you know, they brought you over here to kind of jumpstart the sports program and kind of boost it up a little bit. And that's something you were very successful with in El Paso. Mm-hmm. So what are the things that go into that? You're basically, you know, I don't want to say from scratch, but you're going to do a lot of work to build up the sports program and the outreach with that. So what are the challenges up ahead?
Yeah, I'm really lucky. And you alluded to it. There are sports people here and they have been working hard on this. And so there is a small infrastructure here already. But the biggest challenge is really competition. Sports is big money business, and Houston is a big city, and there are big groups that want control of as many teams as they can have. And they put money behind it. Us at UTMB, we're an academic institution. We don't have money to just throw around at things, of course. We have bigger, I think, responsibilities of teaching and care. And so that, you know, isn't, you know, they didn't fill up my pockets and say, go talk to these people and give them this money so that they'll let you cover them. But I mean, the biggest challenge is really combating that. And I think the biggest thing that we have to offer is, at least in this part of the city and, you know, Galveston, is that, you know, we can put people on the sidelines. And so that's kind of how I've been trying to sell it is, you know, we have a group of surgeons, we have a group of family medicine physicians and residents, we even have some pediatrics people who are interested in being on the sidelines. And we will be there for that. And so that's how I'm trying to sell it. We'll see how it goes. I'm hoping we can also make some contributions to the schools like everyone else does to help with education and equipment and stuff like that. But being an academic institution without private funding, it's challenging.
What about, do you guys have any athletic trainers like hired for the high schools and stuff like that?
We do. It's variable, and I'm meeting with our rehab department tomorrow actually to discuss, you know, what are their capabilities. But that's the basic model of this, and you're aware of this, Mo, is that usually the bigger corporations will hire a trainer or pay for a trainer put that trainer in said school or with said team, and in response to that, the team will allow the physicians on the sidelines and send the patients to them. And that's how it worked with the pro team in El Paso that I worked for and how it usually worked. So, you know, do we have trainers available? I'm going to find out, but we do have a few trainers that we have sent out to some schools, mostly in the Galveston area, because that's where our primary area of practice is, but we'd like to expand that program. And then there may be an option to hire a trainer that maybe isn't one of our UTMB trainers, but will be funded through UTMB, which would be the other option. And that's what the bigger people in Houston do as well. They fund trainers that are trainers from that facility, and they go to the school and provide the coverage. And then the understanding is they send the patients back the other way in response. But it's always up to the patient and the parent. And you guys know this. I mean, you can't tell someone where to go. If mom says, no, I really like this Dr. Weiss guy and I'm going to go see him, then that's the way it goes, and vice versa. And they might decide, no, I like the guy in Houston that I met. Okay, go ahead.
Right.
Really the way the system works, but we're all kind of clamoring to, I guess, get the first exposure to the patient.
Yeah. And, you know, I basically had to make the same sales pitch to the CEO over here of this hospital about why we should, you know, invest in a sports department. And it really is a lot of that stuff. Like it is an investment, but I think the payment on the back end is great. It's not just payment. It's not just referrals, but I mean, you're getting a younger population. You diversify your payer mix. So you're not just seeing Medicaid, Medicare. You actually get a little bit of private insurance. You get your branding, you know, it's all that thing. The athletes really are just a small part of it. And in fellowship, that's really what it was. Like the pro athlete stuff didn't net us much money at all. It was a lot of the high schools, and you know, the high schools, you see the kids, but then you see their family and their parents and their grandparents, and they tell their friends, and it just drives business your way, not just to ortho, but to primary care, OB-GYN, you know, everything. Everyone gets a boost when you have that. So
that was
basically my sales pitch to them too, is look, you're talking about wanting to diversify your payer mix. You know, we live in a poor area. Invest in a sports department. Let me go on the sidelines, but put some branding behind me, and you know, we'll get more payers for you. You just got to invest in it.
That's the bottom line. And I've been actually trying to find some numbers and been looking this up. You know, what is the average hospital reimbursement for an ACL, for example? Mm-hmm. And you know, payments for an ACL in this country will vary from $20,000 to $50,000, depending on where you're talking about. Right. How much that goes to the hospital, I don't know, probably close to three quarters of it. Mm-hmm. But that's the pitch, is you say to the hospital, listen, if we cover this team and I get two ACLs a year, that may cover the majority, if not all, of the cost of an athletic trainer, depending on the market for them in your particular area. And so that's what I'm going to try to sell them on. That's the way that we saw it in El Paso when we took on the locomotive. My department said, we'll pay for this trainer, and we're going to get that back in the two or three surgeries that you do every year. And inevitably, I would do two, three, four surgeries a year. And so we considered it, you know, a wash for that.
Yeah,
and then the exposure, the promotion. And that's the bigger thing, I think, is that. And you get to be the doctors for that team. And little Jimmy, when he hurts his knee, is happy to go see the doctor for the team that he loves.
And for them
to talk about.
Go ahead.
Well, you guys mentioned the word branding a few times now. So what does it mean to really brand yourself in the orthopedic world, and how do you go about doing that? Because we have a logo already. Do we need more than that, or kind of how does that work?
Well, it's all about where your logo gets seen, right?
Yeah.
So you put it on your t-shirt on the sideline, you put it on the billboard, you put it on the scoreboard. You know, if you're really playing at a high level, then, you know, you put it in the commercials, you put it in the timeouts at the basketball game or whatever, you know, this halftime show brought to you by UTMB, right?
Yeah.
And people see that. So it's not really just branding for you. You get the branding by being the, right. You get the branding by being the team doctor or whatever, but the hospital exposes its, you know, puts its name everywhere too.
Both ways. I mean, I've been the guy on the sideline working for teams when my colleagues in whatever city it was had their logo up on the scoreboard, but mm-hmm. they weren't there at the games. And so nobody could go to them. So there's that side of it too. There's definitely an advertising thing, but I think the more important thing that I push is the having us there. And, you know, when your kid gets hurt and we talk about it after the game and I say, listen, here's my card. You know, if they like me and think, yeah, I like that guy, let's go see what he has to say about your injury. Then they come, they don't look at the scoreboard and say, I want to go see that guy. But
yeah.
they might as well, but my
you're right.
was I'd rather them right. come to see me because they like me, not because my name is on the lights.
No, you're right. A lot of that, especially as a community outreach kind of thing, you put your name in the community, you get out there. I was talking more of like the, you know, higher levels, like high level college basketball or football and professional, because they're not necessarily going to see you tucked away in the locker room.
Who's your favorite basketball team, Mo?
Oh, the Pelicans.
Well, you probably know because you just worked there. But if you didn't work there, would you know the name of the doctor who takes care of them?
If I wasn't in orthopedics, no, I would not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you think,
definitely not.
You know, little Johnny watching the Pelicans has any idea? No.
Right. No. But I will say that as far as putting it on a website and when patients are doing Google searches and stuff, if they see something like that, I think that does help, though.
And it does. And that's, you know, if you're good enough for the Houston Texans and you're good enough for me, does that translate into good service and surgery?
No, absolutely not.
Probably does, but just
no. I
but I don't know. Yeah. You know, they don't know.
Yeah, they don't know that. They just see who's you're the doctor for whatever team. You must be good, right?
I'd be willing to bet that every fellowship trained orthopedic surgeon in the Houston area would do an adequate ACL on a pro football player.
Absolutely,
but that's not how it works.
Yeah,
I was at Topgolf last week, and there was at every single station, at the thing where the balls come out, it said Methodist Sports Medicine. Every single station down the line.
That's brilliant.
It's great because you get a good pair of mix, and there's athletic individuals, and it's just right there. You can't avoid seeing it. I didn't want to see it. I just saw it.
That's advertising.
Yeah, it's advertising.
It's good advertising. It's good marketing.
How much that costs?
I took my graffiti and spray painted UTMB for it.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point. The cost side of it is huge. I mean, it's not just trainers, right? At some level, you're talking real estate, you're talking practice facilities, locker rooms, all that kind of stuff. And it's an investment, man. It's definitely an investment. And you got to have a team willing to back you like that. And for the team, it's all about, for the actual team, it's all about access to care, right? They just want someone who's going to be there the night of the surgery. They'll pick up the phone at midnight. They'll get you the MRI the next morning. They'll see you the afternoon. You know, they'll do your surgery the next day. That's what they want. They just want to be able to get it done quick.
That's what the trainers want too. If you talk to them, they just want the backup of like, call you. Can I text you? Will you get my player in as soon as you can? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
it's big business, so it really
for
is.
someone like myself who's not necessarily involved in team coverage and sports and those things, when you have a contract with the school, you know, either high school or college, how long does that last for? Is it year by year renewal or is it several years? It
depends on the contract. I think it's variable. You probably see year to year contracts. Most schools are probably trying to lock in for more than that, because they really are just looking for the coverage, and if they can get it for 5 years, they'll probably take it. But I think it's highly variable.
And the thing is, that contract does not bind any patient referrals to you.
You can't.
It's illegal.
Right.
You can suggest, and you know, the trainers will tell you that even the ones that are contracted, if they are more familiar or happy with another surgeon, they will gently suggest to families that, listen, I know this guy and he's really good. I would suggest you see him. They will do that.
Yeah.
So that definitely definitely still happens. You can't force anyone to go somewhere just because the school has a contract.
The team also isn't bound to keep you as a team doctor either. That's the other thing, right? I mean, that's what happened with the Saints like a couple of years ago.
I guess it depends on what you're talking about now, but the high schools, they tend to just really not want to screw things up because they have everything going, which means an influx of money and a trainer and coverage, and they don't want to screw that up.
It goes both ways.
Some of the smaller schools, especially some of the ones out more towards UTMB out here, they don't have anyone.
And so they're just happy to have something.
Anyone who's willing to do this, they don't want to jeopardize that.
Yeah. So talk about starting from scratch. That's basically what UTMB is doing right now, right? Based on when I left, you had maybe one high school in the Galveston area.
As you guys know, Dr. Smith has been here for a long time and has made a really good name for himself around here. But it's hard to cover a lot of schools, and he has been doing his best. But the other
issue is that there's a lot of, it's like you said before, there's a lot of competition, especially in that area, right? So how do you approach that? Because obviously you don't want to step on any toes. You don't want to be aggressive with these, you know, schools.
Well, I mean, I don't mind stepping on toes a little bit. I mean, I'm not out there to annoy people, but at the same time, I'm going to ask the questions, and if I can offer what they're offering, or I think I can offer more, I'm going to tell them that. But it's ultimately going to be their decision. It's just like talking to a patient, really. You have a patient, and they could go either way, and you think it's better that they go for surgery, then you're going to try to gently convince them while presenting both sides. You know, I'm not going to make the decision for them, but if I think you're better off with surgery and they want my opinion, I may give that to them, even though it's their ultimate decision. And so I'll present, you know, this is what I can do, this is what I have to offer. And if you're happy with your current arrangement, that's fine, which some of the schools I've talked to have been. And I said, okay, well, you know, I'm here. If you need something, you know, let me know. If something doesn't work out, you need a hand, I'm down the road. And some of the other ones that have nothing are just like glad to see like, wow, really? Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get started, and it's going to be slow. And, you know, competing against the big companies in Houston is going to be a challenge, but we're not looking to take over Houston. We're just looking to carve out a little niche, particularly in our area, where we can cover some high school sports and maybe move up a little bit in the future to something bigger if the option presents itself.
Let me ask you practically, how does that work? Like, how do those conversations happen? Do you email like an athletic director? Do you just kind of cold email them?
Here, there's been people that have known people and said, hey, well, I know the trainer for this school. Mm-hmm. We should meet him. Or I know the athletic director. Why don't you come and meet him with me next week? So I've had a fair bit of luck with just that.
Yeah.
People that know people. And immediately that's better because they like, yeah, hey, I know Bill and he's coming to do this. And immediately like, oh, yeah, okay, you know so-and-so. That's great. And the ones that don't, I just kind of say, listen, this is what I've done. This is what I can do. I know that you may or may not have an agreement with so-and-so, but if, you know, things aren't working out or you'd like to try something different, or I try to make the point that I can offer having people there at your games, which is what they really want. And sometimes for the smaller schools, the bigger groups just pay for the trainer and they don't have a physician. And so it ends up getting covered by a physician from a smaller group that's not even part of the same group. And so then now already there's discord and, you know, well, what's happening here? So I've just said, listen, if you are not happy with that, then, you know, give me a call.
And what about commitment on the hospital side? How do you talk to the higher ups? Do you make sure you have commitment in hand before you go to these schools? Well, I mean, obviously you don't want to offer.
Yeah, no, and I haven't. And, you know, I'm familiar as you are with the way these things work, and so are the schools. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty upfront with them and say, listen, I haven't had those discussions yet. I'm going to have those discussions and see what we can do, what we can offer. We're not a big corporation. We're an academic center. But this is what we might be able to do, and I'll let you know. And I mean, we'll see how supportive the UTMB is of this. I expect, and they do put some money behind this already. I don't know how much they're willing to commit, especially in this time of COVID when.
Yeah, that's a whole separate question.
Yeah, things are down, income is down, people are getting laid off. You know, where is the reason to put money into a sports program now? And so that is something that we come up against.
Right.
And worst case scenario, Bill, you and I cover every other night.
That's what it might have to be, honestly. Like, yeah, it's volunteer. We all know that. And it's something that I know that I'm going to have to do if I want to, you know, if you want to take care of athletes, you have to go where the athletes are. And so for me, that's what I'm going to do. I'll cover what I can. I mean, we all have families and academic life as well, but I'll do what I can to be there. And that's what we've been doing with, you know, Ball High School here on the island. We've been able to cover that because it's here. And we have family medicine, Dr. Bardwash, who's covering that. And I've been to a game already with her. And so, you know, we're fulfilling that role. And we hope to do more as we get more people who are interested.
Yeah.
But we can only expand as far as we have people to cover. And if that's what we have to offer, which I think is our primary, you know, this is our thing, we can offer people rather than money, then, you know, we can only stretch ourselves as far as we have people to.
But that's, I mean, that's a huge advantage for an academic center.
I think so.
You have the manpower. You're not like a 5-person private group that where everyone has families and nobody actually wants to cover games, right? You have residents, you have students, like you have family medicine.
We have 5 to 7 surgeons here who have an interest in this. Not every week, of course, but you know, there's 5 to 7 of us who have expressed interest. There's few family medicine expressed interest. We have residents that have expressed interest. There's family medicine residents. So we can probably put a physician at a lot of games.
Yep.
And ideally a primary care and a sports like surgeon at every game.
Yeah.
Residents have no choice too. So, but
genius. And I'm surprised that we were able to do that.
But are you going to pay residents?
No, it's just become part of their sports rotation as they cover a game.
It looks good on the application. If
it does. It does. Well. But Dr. Smith did promise me he would pay me to cover, you know, the 2 years of Ball High that I did.
Dr. Smith owes all of us some
money. He owes all of us some money. So.
He owes all of us some money.
About that money. Yeah, when I worked for the locomotive, we were paid to be there.
Oh, were you?
For the pro teams, they'll pay you a stipend.
It's not much, though. It's really not.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
But for the high schools, you know,
it's volunteer. It's
volunteer.
It's your time.
It's your time, but you do it because you like it and you do it because you want to, that's what you want to do. Like I said before, if you want to take care of athletes, you know, they're not just going to come to you. You have to go to them to some degree and show them that, I get what you're doing. I've been there. I've seen it. I was there on the sidelines with you. And that's why they come to you.
At the high school level, do you also go to their practices at all, or the locker rooms?
Not usually. Sometimes you'll go to a training room. You know, again, just drawing from my experience in El Paso and in fellowships, in some situations, the trainers would call you and say, hey, listen, Johnny hurt his knee today. Can you come have a look at it to see if we need to do an MRI? It depends how you want to work it. Obviously, those visits aren't billed usually. A guy that is like myself who's salaried at a university, if I have the time and it's on my way home, I'll stop in and see it because it doesn't matter to me if I get the clinic visit or not. But private practice, I might think differently, you know, because that's a clinic visit that I'm missing out on now. But, you know, the other way to look at it is you're giving up the clinic visit, but you're getting potentially the surgery if the patient needs something and you saw them and they say, I'll go to him. So it's kind of a bit of, give and take.
And not all schools are treated equally either, right? I mean, obviously you have bigger contracts than others and they get a little preferential attention sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously football is the big thing in Texas, of course. And so the majority of high school sports is football, but there's always, you know, rugby and there's wrestling tournaments and basketball and soccer tournaments that, you know, I've covered in the past. But you're right. The big ticket items are usually, you know, football in the high schools.
Right. And physicals too. Schools love physicals.
Yeah. And that's the family medicine side of it, of course, the primary care side, but that's the other side of it is, the family medicine groups really want those physicals. Now they don't really get paid much for them. Usually, you know, they make an agreement, like it's $10 a physical and they run 200 kids through the physicals. Like we did when I was here as a fellow, you guys were residents. So that also happens. I'm less interested in that part, but some of my partners in this from family medicine and pediatrics, that's what they're looking at is the clinic visits and the potential to do physicals and concussion work, which is not, you know, usually the domain of surgeons, but can be. I'm happy to let them do that. I mean, I don't want to be writing prescriptions.
It was kind of tough. And in fellowship, we had a few high schools that, I mean, actually it wasn't just a few, it was like maybe 10 or 12 because it was a big outreach program, right? It was a huge sports department, but Like 200 to 500 kids on any given physical, just churning through, and it was like a machine. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, it's all about convenience, and it's a service that the groups tend to provide to the high schools or the teams to try to get them all in and out of the way so that they can start the season and make it easier for them to be ready. We did them as well as fellows, and you know, we did them here, as you guys know, when you were residents.
Let's talk about career transitions. So what was it? So how did you exit your previous job? I mean, how did you inform your colleagues and your boss and those things? And
it was definitely a challenge, and I don't know how smooth these things are supposed to go, but I can tell you that mine was not super smooth for a couple of reasons. One, you know, we wanted to get here. I mean, Dr. Lindsay would have had me here in August if he could have, but for me, visa issues, and as soon as my green card stuff all came through and it became possible, you know, he was like, well, as soon as you can get here, you know, we're ready. Yeah. And, but you know, my family wasn't ready. I mean, we literally sold our house in El Paso today and also closed on a house here today. And now we're living in a two bedroom Airbnb here on the island with, you know, my wife and two kids and two dogs. So it really, you know, that side of it definitely was not smooth. And then from the patient side of things, you know, when I initially told my colleagues that I was leaving, you know, Texas Tech had asked me for like 3 to 4 months of transition time. And I was like, I don't have time for that. But that's what they kind of expected. It didn't happen. They worked with me a bit, but there definitely were probably patients who kind of got I know because I get text messages and emails from them now saying, oh, we just heard that you left and just wanted to see where you were and wish you the best. And, you know, so there's a lot of that, which is not ideal either. So it's hard because you want to get there and transition, and things in El Paso weren't great at the time and still aren't. And at the same time, you know, it's hard to leave, you know, your colleagues and your patients and your friends and take your family across Texas, you know, in a short term. So I don't know. There's probably a better way to do it. I guess you live and learn, but.
How do you transition your patients, the care of your patients, the ones that, you know, you're still following up closely?
Yeah, that's been really hard. I mean, some of my high school athletes and professional athletes I'm in contact with still. And, you know, some of them right towards the end, I was very upfront. As soon as I knew that I was leaving, I told them and I said, listen, I'm leaving and I can still do this surgery for you, but I'm not going to be here for your follow-up. And if you want to find someone else, that's okay. If you want me to do it, I'll do it and I'll do my best and I'll find you who I can. I guess the problem in El Paso is that I was the only sports guy really. And so now they don't have one. We have our military colleagues who many of whom are sports trained, but they're not really at Texas Tech full time. They work for the military. And so basically 3 or 4 of them have taken my place and are seeing my follow-ups, seeing my patients that I didn't have time to get to or whatever. But that's how it worked there. There was no one coming in after me, basically.
And then from an insurance standpoint, there's different types of, as you exit, you know, there's tail insurance and there's other types as well. Do you have a specific type of insurance that helped you exit or anything like that?
Personal? Are you talking what kind
malpractice.
Of
insurance? He's talking malpractice.
Yeah.
Malpractice.
Well, as I worked for Texas Tech, so I was covered under a plan through Texas Tech, and I think I just transitioned to the UTMB plan that we're on. I don't have
that was pretty similar then.
Yeah, I don't have my own malpractice insurance because I've always worked for an institution, institution at that. So I think most of it gets taken care of through that. In a private practice, you probably would have to have something that would follow you and whatnot, but
gotcha.
Yeah, for us, easier.
What about transitioning new to a new job? Like what was it like your first day? I mean, you've been there before, but obviously it's a much different place than when you left.
I walked into our office.
it's different, but it's also very much the same. I mean, it's funny because like a couple of the staff people that came after me here, I feel like they felt they already knew me and they're like, oh yeah, we've been hearing about you for years and it's finally nice to have you here. And I think part of that was, I think because I had intended to stay and because of visa stuff, it didn't work out. And so I think Dr. Lindsay and I had continued to talk and So it was kind of always in the back of his head. And I think some of the residents propagated that, oh yeah, Bill Weiss, he's coming back someday or something. So it was kind of funny in that way that it felt like a lot of them and I were already friends, which made it a lot easier. And some of them I already knew, like, you know, obviously Jay and, you know, Dr. Panchwabi's still here, and there's a bunch of others that are still here. So it was a pretty easy transition because I feel like I've been here before. It's not different. Yeah.
And your name was a running joke after you left too, because you remember when you were here, Dr. Panchwabi would like always ask for you for everything. Like if you ever asked him to do anything, he'd say, "Oh, tell Bill to do it. Tell Bill to." Yeah. So after you left, we just kept saying, "Oh, where's Bill? Tell Bill to do it."
Yeah, I know.
Oh, Bill Weiss.
Well, he'll take care of it.
No, he said Bill Weiss.
Yes, I did miss Dr. Panchwabi, of course. And I mean, he's a great colleague, and it's going to be fun. Jay, you know this too from working with him. Yeah, that's what I mean, though. It's a good environment, and I kind of always felt at home here, I think, and that made the decision to come back very easy.
So you're a bit of, I mean, you do a little bit of a lot of stuff, right? So what is your practice going to be like over there?
Well, so this is very different from El Paso for me, because now I have somebody that does foot and ankle, you know, to somebody. Mm-hmm. And I have somebody who does total joints, and I have people that do trauma and pediatrics more so than I had there. So I will still kind of do whatever comes my way, but if I feel like someone else can do a better job of something, then I'm going to send it to them, and I'm going to focus more on the sports side and stick to the sporty side of shoulders and elbows and knees and foot and ankle, kind of leave what I don't enjoy as much to my colleagues, which is a great thing to have.
Yeah.
I think the nice thing too with, you know, since we've expanded so much off the island, we still have the chance to kind of step out of our comfort zone almost, in terms of, I'm a foot and ankle guy, but I'm probably more than half of my cases have been trauma cases of some sort. Because I'm off the island and I'm available to do the trauma. And I think that's a great thing, at least when you're starting a new job, just to keep yourself busy while you're building your elective practice.
And so, otherwise, forget it. I tell a lot of surgeons that are younger that, you know, you don't want to paint yourself into a corner too soon, because in 5 to 10 years, if you change jobs, you're not going to remember how to do all that stuff. So I've tried to keep my practice as well pretty general. And trauma is something we all can do, not everything, but you know, the simple stuff we can do. And I would recommend that, you know, young surgeons do that as well, so that they don't forget those skills, even though they may want to just be a left knee arthroscopist the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Any, are you doing any spine?
No. Although I did teach you spine patients, and I promptly sent them to someone else.
Yesterday. Yeah.
I mean, I'll do the sporty side of just assessing and therapy, essentially, but I'm not doing any spine. That, you know, that's an interesting thing, that orthopedics, you guys have some of these people here still, and I did when I was a resident, the old guard that did spine and joints and trauma. You know, those men and women are few now, but we have a few of them here still, and I trained with a few of them too, and they always amazed me that, you know, they'd still do that, whereas now everybody picks either spine or ortho everything else.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's an interesting change in the way that we practice.
Yeah, when I came here, they thought that I did spine, like on top of everything, because I, you know, it's an older place, so I think they just assumed general orthopedics did everything.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't do that. Just send it somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely do not miss taking spine call. And like as a resident, that was always my first thing. Are we covering spine tonight? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mine was hand.
Yeah.
I think hand call just killed me every time, because there's always something that came in that would take 2 hours to do. Yeah. Which I told Jay this the other day. It's like, I don't realize why we did all these revision amputations and stuff in the ER. I mean, I know why we did them, but you could easily do them in the OR the next day if you don't have anything else to do, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like you could do a better job in the OR with them asleep.
You do. I think so too. I don't know. That's a great question. In Canada, the case would be made that, you know, OR time is expensive. So if you
can, that's true.
In the ED, it's cheaper. I mean, we used to take our syndesmosis screws in the clinic, because booking an OR takes away your OR time. So that was the excuse there. Here in the U.S., I mean, working at a state institution, you could also make that case.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I don't know. That's a good question. You also need a staff person to be in the OR, right? That's the rule. Whereas if you do something in PD as a resident, you can do that without staff supervision, and that may play into it as well.
That may have definitely played into it at 2 a.m. when we're the resident.
Don't kid yourself.
Yeah. All right. Was that an hour?
I think we're coming
Let's
up.
Let's do it.
Yeah,
pretty cool.
Want to talk about fantasy football?
No, not at all.
Okay, I'm not doing so good either.
I'm gonna forget this year happened. I think all three of us are.
We're all doing badly.
Right off.
Yeah, it's been weird, and it's such a weird situation over there too. I mean, not to get back on COVID, but I mean, there's been weeks where big players are out, and I didn't know what I was gonna do with like bench stuff and IR slots and all that.
I know. I remember your text messages about, what are we going to do this week when there are two games that got moved?
Yeah.
Yeah. We all ignored you, I think.
Well, no, I said that because I had people asking me. I mean, obviously not you, because I don't think you looked at your team since you drafted it or since the computer drafted it for
you. I'm looking closely. What people doing? We're still in the running, man. We have like three teams in my division that are 4-6. So I'm one of those teams. We're still alive. I just got beat pretty this week.
But yeah, no, it's been a weird year for the NFL, and
it's been a weird year in general.
Yeah. So, all right, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
All right.
Thanks, Bill. See you around.
You bet.
All right. Thanks, man.
See you in like 10 minutes at a research meeting.
Yes, exactly.
And that'll do it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thanks to Dr. Weiss for giving us an hour of his time. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. If you do like what we're doing, please do us a big favor and leave us a 5-star review on whatever podcasting platform you are using. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at our Twitter handle, at OrthoTalkPod, or you can email us, theorthopodcast@gmail.com. If you don't like what we're doing, send us an email. Don't leave us a bad review. Just tell us what we were doing wrong and what you want to fix. So you can catch all of our other old episodes at our website, orthotalkpod.com. And I hope you guys enjoy the episode. We will see you back next week, and thank you for tuning in.